Blog Talk Radio.
Hello and welcome to Virtues of Peace. My name is Hope Elizabeth May. I'm joined by Taylor Ackerman.
Hello.
Michael Buzzy.
Hello, everyone.
And Randy Olson.
Hello, hello.
So we are back for a second pass at discussing the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Historically, this treaty received its 50th ratification a couple weeks ago. It will enter into force, that has become effective on January 22nd, 2021. And at the end of last week's show, and we encourage you to check out that show to round out this discussion, we're trying to do like a 101 introductory approach to this treaty and public international law of which this treaty is a part. And at the end of our show last week, this three-page wonderful article written by Elihu Root called The Need of Popular Understanding of International Law was mentioned. And we will be talking about that today in the beginning of the show, and then hitting again the preamble, the preambular language of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. Again, the preamble sets out the spirit of the treaty, the sort of philosophical objective of the treaty. It's not the legalese binding articles in the treaty, but it does have significance. So we'll be talking about further sentences in the preamble. I also wanted to connect with our show last week and just remind our listeners that this podcast is really focused on the excavating of untold stories of what's called the peace through law movement. Peace, international peace, is always the goal. We've talked about what that means in some of our earlier shows. It is not simply the absence of war, but law, international law, is a very important part of that goal. And as we'll be talking about today, education is a very important part of that goal. That has always been the goal since we started organizing the world internationally, beginning in the 19th century, really. And Bertha von Suttner, who I try to mention every show, this was her goal, and she inspires Nobel to create the Peace Prize, which is connected to today's show. And she, in her writings, distinguishes between the goal of replacing armed conflict with nonviolent dispute mechanisms, so courts and so forth. That we have to create these courts. We have to organize the world to create these institutions which replace armed conflict as a way of solving controversy. So it's important to conceptually distinguish that goal from the limitation or prohibition of certain kinds of weapons. So the treaty, it's interesting, it's the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. But as I will try to talk about later, you know, it's absolutely linked to the peace movement. But I think nonetheless it's important to distinguish those two goals. So before we start talking about the Elihu Root article, which you can download on our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com, and don't be intimidated by this article. It's only three pages. It's a three-page long article. It was Page 1, Volume 1, Issue 1 of the American Journal of International Law. So before going into that article, and we're just going to have like a few quotes from each page, actually, and we'll talk about that article, I just want to open it up to see if any of you have a comment on this conceptual distinction between, you know, the goal of the peace movement on the one hand, and then this limitation of weapons or the prohibition of certain kinds of weapon on the other. And I'll just start with you, Taylor, to see if anything to comment on that distinction.
Yeah, so I think part of it is taking steps for the betterment of humanity. And while we're working towards peace by outlawing the very worst parts of war, isn't achieving that full goal of peace, it's the idea of applying law, I think, to war and showing that they're in getting countries to practice restraint, practice the practice of restraint. And in that, we're taking steps towards sort of humanizing countries and statesmen and their approach to dispute. Mm-hmm. And so even though, obviously, you know, by outlawing certain aspects of war, we're still enabling war to occur, we are making these positive steps towards, you know, mm-hmm. humanity and making war less barbaric, even if it always will be barbaric.
Mhm. Yeah, thanks. And Michael?
Yeah, when you had opened it up to us and I started, and even when you were talking about it before and I was starting to, you know, formulate my thoughts on this issue, I would really echo Taylor's sentiment, and that it struck me in the same way that while the goal of, you know, this process of denormalizing war and armed conflict as a way to solve disputes and sort of changing that realm of understanding to one that involves action through just peaceable, nonviolent dispute solving through sitting down communication, I think that is the ultimate end goal, as you've stated, and that sort of these steps of, you know, prohibiting nuclear weapons, that in a way begins that humanization process and removes those as options on the table, which then only furthers this gradual, continual process to get to a point where we will no longer need armed, violent conflict to solve disputes. And through that process, it involves a lot of education, a lot of engagement, a lot of, you know, baking these ideas and norms into society, starting very young, that so those who then come of age in a world where hopefully nuclear weapons are no longer on the table, that violent conflict will then seem less and less reasonable, and it will be more about solving disputes through discussion, arbitration, stuff like that. So that was my sort of thoughts on it.
Cool. Randy?
So there's two simple things. The first is right underneath the surface. You know, we're discussing, like, one of the foundational sets of ideas for the peace through arbitration, peace through law movement. And this idea has something underneath it that I think is rather useful to keep in mind. And it's like, okay, if you have an alternative solution mechanism for armed conflict, it doesn't mean it's always going to be used, but it means it could be. And the reason I'm bringing this up is because there's a subtle implication to that, which it implies one of the axioms of the movement, which is that people have the capacity to think and to make decisions, and that, like, having all additional options on the table is going to be a good idea, guaranteed, and it's worth pursuing for everyone, even the warmongers. And that, to me, is something that's useful to think about, because, you know, saying, and, you know, Elihu Root actually goes on later to say this, but saying that you're against war doesn't do anything, but creating a mechanism that provides alternatives to war does, in fact, do a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And
then,
so
of course,
that's the
yeah. And I just want to add, and then, of course, you said we have to be, like, reminded that these other things exist. And as we've discussed on the show, it's in the Hague Convention on the Pacific Settlement of Disputes. There's an article that permits or maybe even obliges state parties to that treaty to remind imminent belligerents, you know, countries that are about to go at it, that this other thing exists, this other process exists. So, yeah, this forgetting, I think, is part of the problem. But okay, sorry, I interrupted.
Yeah, yeah. So no problem. No, I'll just reemphasize the same thing, and then we'll move forward. But I really want to stress the fact that built into the idea that this additional mechanism has value is the assumption that people make decisions on both sides of a conflict, and that having the option is important. And there's something very seriously non-trivial about the fact that we're humanizing both sides of the dispute, which is the whole point of an arbitration system. It's like, look, you're a human being. You can't be judging your own case. Let's create a mechanism so that you don't have to be. And there's so much brilliance in that, even though it's easy to put on the table. It's hard to make into a mechanism. And in fact, we're living in a world where that's already taken place. So, yeah, I think that's what we're going to basically unpack today.
Mm-hmm. Cool, thanks. So we will just begin with the article again. It's on our show resources page. It's 3 pages long. And I'm going to begin with a quote that you can find on page 1 of that article. Again, this is from The Need of Popular Understanding of International Law by Elihu Root. This is published in 1907. This is really important because this is before the United Nations, which is going to be tied into the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. It's before NGOs as we know it. There were NGOs in 1907, but a sort of different animal. And I also want to mention that Elihu Root in 1912 wins the Nobel Peace Prize for his work in international relations and international ethics, international peace and justice. That's really important linkage, because the International Campaign for the Abolition of Nuclear Weapons, also called ICAN, wins that same prize in 2017. And as we've said numerous times, that prize can be traced back to Bertha von Suttner. Nobel creates it for her, really, and she's the first woman to win it in 1905. So what we're reading is, you know, 5 years, is printed 5 years before Elihu Root wins the Nobel Peace Prize, and on page 1 of this 3-page article, he says, and this is the second paragraph, or actually the third paragraph at the top, "One of the chief obstacles to the peaceable adjustment of international controversies is the fact that the negotiator or arbitrator who yields any part of the extreme claims of his own country and concedes the reasonableness of any argument of the other side is quite likely to be violently condemned by great numbers of his own countrymen who have never taken the pains to make themselves familiar with the merits of the controversy or have considered only the arguments on their own side." End of quote. And so I picked this passage to talk about because the very, you know, the first 5 words, one of the chief obstacles, one of the obstacles to peace, peace through law, is quite frankly ignorance, ignorance of the arguments of the other side. And I just wanted to flag that. Again, his phrase is, his own countrymen have never taken the pains to make themselves familiar with the merits of the controversy or have considered only the arguments on their own side. So there's ignorance of the opposing arguments, and this creates a kind of, you know, arrogance on one side of one's countrymen. Bertha von Suttner makes the same point. She does say in multiple places that ignorance, which comes in different forms, is one of the enemies of the peace movement. And this is why education is so important, that it's, you know, education being the antidote to ignorance. So I'll just leave it there and go around, starting with Taylor. And if you have nothing to comment, no problem, we'll just move on. But Taylor, any response to this sentence by Hilaihu Root?
Yeah, I think the concept of ignorance is so important, and the fact that people are unaware of other arguments and even their own arguments, people so often will just make assertions and not even have the rationale to back up their own assertions, let alone the rationale of the other side. And so I think it really brings in that education component. And the responsibility to educate ourselves and educate others so that we can better make better policies and hold our governments to account.
Yeah, thanks. Michael?
Yeah, when I had heard you read this awesome quote, and then when I had read it myself, it took me a few times. Like, you know, the first pass is just sort of the initial, you know, head scratching. Hang on, let me reorient myself with this. And then you go over a few more times, and then you allow the profoundness of it to really sink into you. And that's what it certainly did for me. It struck me, this whole article, quite frankly, struck me as incredibly relevant, that this same call that Elihu Root is making in 1907 still applies, I would say, just as much today in the year 2020 in terms of international law, international relations, because I think it's not a mindset that many individuals put themselves in when they think of, you know, interactions with other nations and stuff. This, your quote also struck me as relevant in the sense that it takes a great deal of empathy and understanding, and I think dispelling of ignorance and education to be able to sort of take your mindset out of your current view of the argument, the realm you find yourself in with your own domestic side, and then place yourselves in the shoes of the individuals on the other side. Where are they coming from? Why do they view this argument as rational? Where is their reasoning and stuff coming from? And it really struck me as relevant in the context of a state like North Korea, between the ongoing negotiations and interactions between the United States and North Korea, that, you know, we view them as, in Kim Jong-un, as this insane dictator who holds nuclear weapons and has no rationale to his thought. They just need to adhere to what we're telling them to do and all will be fine. And then you sort of flip the argument and put yourselves into the North Korean shoes, and you say, well, here's this fledgling state that has managed to survive for 70 plus years. They view nuclear weapons as one of the sole ways in which their state will continue to exist in the way that they know it. So they view it as an extension of their own survival. And if you were to be in that mindset, it would seem very rational to you that if this thing is, if nuclear weapons are one of the primary facets at your disposal that you can use to allow yourself to remain in your current state of existence, then that is what you are going to use. So I think, and that is just one situation, if you look around globally at this current time, I think dealing with Iran is another really good example. Dealing with anything Middle East-wise, the ongoing negotiations between Israel and other Middle Eastern and Arab states, that it's just a very, and it all just goes down to those basic tenets of empathy, understanding, peaceful and engaging dialogue, and an immense spelling of ignorance and recognizing where your own biases are coming from. I think all of those facets are immensely important.
Yeah, and before I go to Randy, I just want to add to that in connection with the treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons, I mean, not at least in the circles that I frequent, which is, you know, college undergraduates, there's not a lot of information about it. Like, people are just ignorant that this is happening, that there is this treaty, and that the United States is, yeah, sort of like absolutely agitating against the treaty. And again, Taylor made the point that, you know, sometimes we're ignorant of our own arguments that are being made. And I think, yeah, just to underscore again, there's there's understanding, like, what is our own country's position on this treaty and why are they taking that position, which is, you know, a study in itself. And then there's all of these other countries and why are they taking the position that they are. And that's just very humbling and I hope, you know, sort of whittles away at the arrogance that people have. And as Taylor said, not even coming from necessarily rational understanding of any argument, but more like a kind of emotional knee-jerk reaction. Randy?
So this sentence opens up a number of doors for me, and they center around the fact that this one sentence provides the entire mechanism whereupon tribalism emerges.
Mm.
And the feeling, the sense of tribalism that we can point to from a number of different places to make the point, but basically it's like, just to return to the quote briefly, you know, when the negotiator or arbitrator yields any part of the extreme claims of his own country,
mm-hmm.
like that process of saying the other side, they're human.
Mm-hmm.
They've thought about this at least a little bit. They have something to say.
Mm.
There's immediately this process that takes place right in that moment where there's a sense of betrayal from the side of ignorance, like the side of not willing to accept the like outside force, the outside opinion as anything that could be, you know, could hold truth. There's this internal, visceral betrayal thing going on. And then later in the sentence, you know, it's like, it's because the people haven't, quote, taken the pains to make themselves familiar with the merits of the controversy. And there's something really special about that, too. There's this definition baked in about how learning occurs, then namely through pains. And it's like, well, why? In order to learn something new that you think you know about already, part of that structure inside has to be destroyed. There's something that has to be taken away. And it's really useful, as far as I'm concerned, to know that. And it's like, well, so why do people choose ignorance? Why is there a will to ignorance? It's because there's an avoidance of pain. There's a serious part of a person that doesn't want that internal conflict to result in pain because there's a demolition of a belief inside them that must take place in order for the growth to occur. And so you have serious reasons to stay on the side of ignorance, and then you have a serious response of betrayal when somebody goes outside of the circle and does something that acknowledges the intelligence of another person who happens to disagree with you. And those two forces work together to create bubbles that we live in. And I'll say one thing to bring the idea close to home. You know, yesterday, I was in the middle of two people who I know who are arguing about abortion, and this was taking place, like, in a very different way, but in the same way, where it's like, if this is a social issue, it's not a matter of international law, but the exact same mechanism was taking place, where, you know, people were just talking past each other about an issue, because in order to accept the other person as even mildly intelligent and understand, well, yeah, you think, like, what you're saying is reasonable, but in order to get to that, well, what you're saying is reasonable, but in order to get to that place, there's an enormous amount of demolition internally that neither person was willing to do. And so they're just not actually communicating. And basically what the arbitration movement and what the entire system of international law does is it creates that space so that both parties don't have to do that entire internal overhaul completely on their own. The arbitration process is the support mechanism through which the internal development can take place.
Mm-hmm. Cool. All right. So that, again, that quote, you can find it on page one. It's the beginning of the third paragraph. We're now going to move to a quote that one finds on page two. And this is Michael's quote. So, Michael, if you could read that and then talk a little bit about it.
Yeah, this quote is, like you said, it's on page two. It is contained within the second paragraph on page two, and it reads, "The more clearly the people of a country understand their own international rights, the less likely they are to take extreme and extravagant views of their rights, and the less likely they are to be ready to fight for something to which they are not really entitled." Quote. And I think, truly, a lot of the themes that we have touched on within our 25 minutes together so far apply here as well, that it takes, I thought Randy put it very eloquently, that it's all about this dispelling of your own personal biases and dispelling your own ignorance, which you sort of use as a shield of for yourself to prevent you from having to undergo that painful process of becoming disillusioned with what you once held near and dear. And it's the dispelling of this very cavalier, crusader-esque view that your opinion and the argument that you're hearing, if you're even completely in tune and not even, you may even contain ignorance to the own argument which you are defending, if, like Taylor had said, if you don't know all the facets there. And it's this dispelling of the belief that you are utterly infallible. And I think empathy and understanding play a great role in it as well, that you must recognize yourself as, view yourself as a citizen of a world instead of one individual nation, and that you must view yourself as one among many individuals equally real, and that by undergoing that process, you'd be in a place way more open and willing to engage in dialogue instead of this sort of totalitarianistic fervor, crusader-esque attitude that can emerge through sort of reinforcing the views and arguments that you have and completely dehumanizing and viewing the other as utterly wrong and nothing to even be considered in any facet.
Mm-hmm. Right. So there's these twin objects of, you know, there's the ignorance and then there's the understanding. And, you know, obviously, as we've been saying, this relates to education being such a crucial plank. And again, you know, it's a point that needs to be made again and again. And it's popular understanding. It's public education. And so this involves the processes that you're talking about, Michael, and, you know, confronting your own ignorance, and you know, that's quite a task. It's quite a task to get someone to do that, and so yeah, the whole project is quite immense. And we'll now go to quote number three, which is on page three. And Randy, this is your quote. So if I'm correct, it's at the very top of page three, the end of the first full paragraph.
So I'm going to begin with what says, "The true basis of peace among men is to be found in a just and considerate spirit among the people who rule our modern democracies, in their regard for the rights of other countries, and in their desire to be fair and kindly in the treatment of subjects which give rise to international controversies." And there's two keys to this, as far as I'm concerned. You know, the true basis of peace is built upon a just and considerate spirit, which has a few implications that I think are important. You know, built into this is a set of presuppositions, yet again, that there are spirits within people that can have either just and considerate and compassionate components to them, or not. And, you know, it's a simple point, but I think it's really, it can't be stressed enough, because at the really foundation of international law are norms. There are sets of expectations. There are beliefs. And one of them has to do with recognizing the intrinsic value of another being, which is built on basically a belief about the intrinsic value of an individual and their ability to make decisions. So the individuals that are making decisions for large-scale democracies, modern democracies, and the people who are responsible for making decisions on behalf of large groups of people, they have to do something, and they have desires. And this is really important, right? There's this psychological component to decision-making at this scale, which, of course, again, is so simple, so obvious, but it can't be stressed enough, as far as I'm concerned, that people have to have desires to be fair and kindly in the treatment of subjects which give rise to international controversies. And it's really important to remember that all desires have motivations. It's not possible, technically, to have a desire without a motive. So we have to have the motives in place so that the people who are ruling the modern democracies are feeling some kind of desire towards fair and kindly treatment. You know, there's like a scaffolding process that has to be really thought out, and we have to structure our democracies and structure our societies and structure our international organizations in such a way that make the motivations possible that lead to the desires to be kindly, to be considerate, to be compassionate. And, you know, I'm not trying to reinvent the wheel here. I'm just like, we have to think hard about what kind of things we're building and what that is motivating people to do in the future. And, as far as I'm concerned, and as far as my root is concerned, that is the true basis of peace among men.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, and elsewhere he says things like, you're not going to find peace in laws and institutions, but in the character of men. He says things like that elsewhere. And I think, that... that is extremely important. It's a point that you've made, Randy, multiple times, that, you know, it starts with people, and a nation is, you know, individuals, and you have to, you know, work on the individual and the individual's character.
It's such a obvious thing, but like when we take for granted now that we can watch like the UN General Assembly meetings on television, right? That these things are recorded and we can watch these things, and or Congress or whatever, you know, any government body. But it's so crazy to imagine that, okay, well, here's a person, and then they have a little name tag in front of them that you know signifies which country they represent. And somehow we forget that that's a person, and they're saying things, and they might not be saying exactly what they're supposed to say as far as the people of their country are concerned. Like, they're an individual. And so it's like, it's so obvious, it's so simple, but it's a non-trivial thing to consider that, like, we're dealing with people, and we have to treat other nations like they're composed of people.
Mm-hmm. Cool. So before we move on to the preamble of the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and it is connected with everything that we're saying, and that connection will be made in a sec, but I just want to open it up to see if anybody has any final thoughts about the Root article or any of the passages that we have been discussing, things that we have been saying. I'll start with Taylor.
Yeah, I think taking a few steps back to the concept of understanding international rights. I think it's so interesting that right after Root spoke about rights, he spoke about the obligations and duties. And just going back to that understanding of one understands their rights, it seems almost inevitable that one understands also their obligations and duties to the international community. And I think it's of note that one of those obligations is to understand your rights and to educate yourself on what is happening and to do what you can to respect the rights of others. And so I think that goes into the idea of when you understand your own rights, you're also understanding that you have duties to other people.
Mm-hmm.
And I just thought that was interesting.
Yeah.
That he put the duty right after the discussion of rights.
Mm-hmm. Yep. Rights imply duties, and duties tend to imply rights. So, not all the time, though. Michael?
I love the individualistic nature of all of this broad, complex international world of relations. It was something I most certainly was not cognizant of when I first began to make myself aware and a little less ignorant on these subjects. Granted, I have a long way to go, but I'm proud of the progress that has been made, because for most of my life, you look at these large, complex international organizations such as the United Nations, sort of like continental ones, like the European Union, and you just think it's all of just these individuals serving as catalysts for functions, for different compacts and agreements to be carried out in the allocations of funds. But no, at its core, like Randy had said, it's very simple. It's just like this whole understanding of the self and dispelling your own ignorance and viewing yourself as an individual and realizing that the other people you're dealing with are also individuals equally real to you. And while it is so plainly simple, it is immensely difficult. That is not something easy to undergo by any means. In a way, it would be easier if you were just a cog in these international organizations allowing for certain functions to happen. But to view the individuals you're dealing with across that table as a person and, you know, wanting to know their story and their motivations and, you know, where they stand, what their hurt is, and all of this groundwork that needs to be laid to build a more empathetic world, that's hard, because that's work that must happen on an internal individual level, and that's painful. But the growth that you undergo because of that is immense.
Cool. And Randy, I mean, any follow up from?
2 sentences and then we'll move on. But I mean, yeah, the individual makes its way up to the international scale alarmingly quickly. It's because of like the idea of a nation state isn't necessarily that it's comprised of lots of individuals so much as, you know, it's like this a fractal relationship where it is an individual just at a different scale. Mm-hmm. And so, like, once I started thinking about it like that, it stopped being confusing. It just was, it's a lot of information, but none of it's complex. Like, in terms of, you know, like, it's not as hard as mathematics. It's just a whole lot of simple things all in a big folder, you know?
Mm-hmm.
So, yeah, that's all.
So we're going to transition to the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, and we're going to, again, take another pass at the preamble. And given the discussion, I'm going to begin with my sentence, if I may, which is the very first sentence of the preamble on the Treaty of the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons. You can download this on our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. And here's the sentence. The sentence is, determined to contribute to the realization of the purposes and principles of the Charter of the United Nations. So first, the charter is referred to. And so if you really want to understand this treaty, you have to go and look at the charter and understand what the purposes and principles of the charter are. The Charter of the United Nations also has a preamble, and I'm just going to read a couple of sentences from that, which I think are very relevant to this treaty on the prohibition of nuclear weapons. The very first sentence that you see in the preamble of the Charter of the United Nations is, "To save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, which twice in our lifetime has brought untold sorrow to mankind." And, second sentence, "To reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights, in the dignity and worth of the human person, in the equal rights of men and women, and of nations large and small." And it goes on. In this section, it has two more sentences, and the preamble is longer than four sentences. But those are the first two sentences of the preamble of the charter. To save succeeding generations from the scourge of war, and again, to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights and the dignity and worth of the human person. I mean, you're now off and running. So it has been said, you know, the purpose of the United Nations is to abolish war. Wars and self-defense are of course still allowed, and there are other complications. But I wanted to flag that, and I wanted to flag the language about fundamental human rights and the dignity and worth of the human person. And the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, I can't find anywhere where it, and I think it's so interesting, it never mentions the word dignity. When I think of, you know, like, what is it about these weapons that are so abhorrent? They do infringe upon dignity. And I, again, like, dignity, of course, is something that needs to be unpacked. But I think just intuitively, as we've been saying on the show, the idea of such an indiscriminate weapon whose effects don't even, like, really materialize. You could survive the blast. You could be living for, you know, a number of years, 10, 20, 30 years. Some of the effects take 30 years to fully manifest. The way that they destroy the body, the pain, the indiscriminate nature really seems to violate human dignity. And the treaty goes on to talk about, in connection with human rights, again, the Charter of the UN says to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights. And that, of course, had to be built. I mean, you had to have the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and then you have, you know, international human rights law. And so there's all of this, these other pieces and this larger framework that this treaty needs to be understood as part of. And I'm going to now, since I'm talking about human rights, play a clip. You can actually, this is like a 6-minute video that you can get on our show resource page, virtuesofpeace.com. And this is Marianne Glendon, who is, you know, a world expert on the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. There's like a 6-minute video clip on our show resources page. This is a 1.5-minute excerpt from that. And she's talking about the Universal Declaration of Human Rights. And she says in this clip, as you'll hear, that the whole purpose of the declaration is like really education. So again, I just see a link between like that and the what we're taking from the 1907 Elihu Root article. And so, like, you see it again. So the treaty makes reference to it by referring to the charter, by referring to international human rights law. The treaty does make reference to that explicitly. And again, that if you look at the Universal Declaration, education is so important. So here's a clip that underscores that.
I think it's important to distinguish between the goal of a document like the Universal Declaration and the goal of other activities in the human rights area that were going on at the time and that have been carried on since. The Universal Declaration was really not about enforcement. It was about enculturation. It was about setting conditions so that horrible things wouldn't happen, or so that the probabilities of atrocities would be reduced. But education in particular is what the Universal Declaration is all about. That was the idea. That, in fact, there's something in the preamble about the Declaration standing as a sign to all peoples, to all nations. And the idea was that through education, they would somehow find a way to, with different emphases according to the culture, to make these rights a reality. You could almost think of it as a dream about a competition in excellence. There might be different paths toward the goal of protecting the dignity of every man, woman, and child in the world, but nobody could leave any of the rights out.
Again, so that's Marianne Glendon. You can watch the whole clip from which that is an excerpt on our show resources page at virtuesofpeace.com. And again, I play that clip because the very first sentence of the preamble in the Treaty on the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons mentions the Charter of the United Nations. And if you look at that charter, it mentions that the purpose of the United Nations is to save succeeding generations from the scourge of war and to reaffirm faith in fundamental human rights. And so from that language, you do get this further building of the Declaration of Human Rights, which Marianne Glennon is talking about, and then international human rights law as we know it, which again is referred to in the treaty. I'll just open it up to see if anybody has a comment on this bit, starting with Taylor.
So I really loved her analogy to international human rights being a competition for excellence, and how there are different paths. And I think especially coming from a Western point of view, it's so simple for easy for us to think of civil and political rights, but there are these economic and social rights too. And the idea of there being different paths, I think in terms of the nuclear disarmament, there really aren't alternative paths in terms of excellence if we want to keep our human rights, because they basically, if there's nuclear war, it undermines civil and political rights and undermines economic and social rights. But at the same time, I think when we talk about, you know, this idea of understanding different arguments and understanding our own arguments that we sort of started off the show with, it really points to the need to understand that just because, you know, we really emphasize, for example, civil and political rights in the United States, doesn't mean that countries who are focusing on economic and social rights are lesser than us in terms of human rights. And it sort of, when we understand that, it goes to sort of Michael's point about understanding the rights of other people and how when we understand our own rights, we also understand that other countries are doing things differently, but not necessarily better or worse all around. Like there may be certain rights where we do better in, or that we've been taught and educated on. If we fully understand our rights, we'll understand that there are other rights that maybe other states do better than us. And so I think it adds a humanizing component, especially when we think about nuclear war, because you don't want to nuke other people just because they do it differently than you. You don't want to go to war with people and kill people and destroy their dignity just because they are approaching sort of the project of humanity slightly differently, because in the end it's all this quote-unquote competition of excellence.
Cool. Michael?
Yes, I second Taylor in that. I absolutely loved the clip. And I think
for me, it was an amazing framework through which to view humanity in our 21st century era in terms of international relations. And this whole idea of enculturation was one that really struck me as well, that through education continuously, and even those who feel that though they have a good grasp on it, constant repetition and reiteration, that it's just something that is baked into the fiber of society, I think is a very profound element. And that will also serve as a catalyst for this race to the top, this competition of excellence that she discusses, which I think is absolutely a brilliant way to go about it. And I think a lot of individuals would benefit from knowing what the Universal Declaration of Human Rights is. Through discussions with my peers and adults in my life who have had immense influence, family, to various others, that this is not something they know exists, which to me is such a, like, such a disservice to their humanity. And it's just, it, in a way, you just feel no, and then you can then be that catalyst that gives them the knowledge to then understand that this exists and sort of change the way they think to encompass this as a facet of the reality. I think that's a really important thing. And even I really like Taylor's point as well, that when different nations are all racing towards the top in this competition of excellence, and, you know, there might be emphasis placed on other rights, but none are left out. So economic rights might be emphasized in one, whereas political might be emphasized in another, which doesn't mean particularly that one or the other is doing anything wrong. It's just the way in which the avenues that they are exploring to sort of reach this place where all rights of the individuals in their country are respected and their human dignity is upheld is different. And to respect the diversity and to learn from those different avenues in our own pursuit to that end goal is immensely important.
And I want to add that the Marianne Glendon, she mentions the preamble of the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, and the language there is actually very strong because it says that every person and every institution, and the word is shall, which means must, shall strive by teaching and education to respect these funds. So it's like a duty of the declaration to know it. And if people don't know it, it's not going to work. Point number one. Point number two is the declaration, like the experiments that we're talking about, like one country emphasizes civil and political rights, another country emphasizes economic, social, and cultural rights. That wasn't, like, they weren't supposed to be severed. They were part of, like, a holistic view. And so, like, the experimentation is not necessarily, like, separating the two. I think Marianne Glendon thinks that's an aberration to separate the two like that. But that there needs to be this holistic acceptance of all of the rights in the declaration, and then, you know, countries emphasize certain ones within that, but don't ignore, don't, so there's like two different, as some of you know, two different instruments of law, and it's like it's beyond the scope of this conversation, but what's happened is there's been, yeah, a division of these two, and it wasn't supposed to be like that. Okay, Randy.
Well, I'd like to make a comment about, like, the structure of this sentence and how it's, you know, it's highlighting, like, something that is obvious to people who study law, but it's not obvious to people who don't. Namely, that laws often refer to other laws, or treaties often refer to other treaties, and there's this idea of precedent that gets to something very useful to think about, that, like, laws and rights and duties that are associated to those to laws, they're not just spawning out of nowhere magically. They're a product of things in the past that people have agreed to. And so in the world of international relations, international law, international situations in general, there are these, again, norms, these agreed upon things that get referred to and then referred to somewhere else, and then people take them for granted over time. And one of the really useful things about new treaties pointing to the old treaties is to remind us of the hard conversations that other people already had, where the best arguments were presented against the best arguments at the time. And that doesn't mean that it's always going to be true, and it doesn't mean that it's always the right answer. There are very serious times where people have to revisit old laws and old judgments and old rulings in order to improve upon the past. But generally speaking, this idea, it's really useful to know that, like, law is a conservative force in the world of humans, and it changes slowly over time because it's using something that worked already, and it's using the things to build on. And so, I don't know, I wanted to just say something obvious like that, because it's not obvious to people who don't study law.
Cool. And in line with that, I think that we should go to your sentence, Randy, in the preamble, and then we'll go to Michael's, and then we'll end the show after, you know, a wrap-up after that. But,
okay.
Randy, can you read the sentence? So, again, we're talking about... We're talking about a bunch of preambles thus far. We talked about the preamble of the Charter of the United Nations and the Universal Declaration of Human Rights, but we're going back to the preamble on the Treaty of the Prohibition of Nuclear Weapons, which is the focus of this show. Just trying to process it, that's what we're doing. We talked about my sentence, which makes reference to the UN Charter. Now we're going to move to Randy's sentence.
Which is referred to as Martin's Clause. And it reads, reaffirming that any use of nuclear weapons would also be abhorrent to the principles of humanity and the dictates of public conscience. And this is packed full of, you know, million-dollar words. But the thing I want to stress is, okay, number one, the idea of using nuclear weapons is abhorrent to what? Well, it's abhorrent to something that would, it's like this principles of humanity. And it's stated in such a way that it's like everybody seems to, everybody would agree. And whether this is true or not is obviously up for, like, this is something people could disagree with and have a conversation with, but it's like, who is actually in favor of kind of things that nuclear weapons do? Well, this clause is it's implying, well, no humans. This is the principles of humanity. And the phrase that I'd like to sit on for a little while is the dictates of public conscience. This term, I want to dig into this term of public conscience, because, you know, the way that it's phrased implies that it exists and that it has, you know, it's being treated like a person, right? Like the public has one of the faculties of the individual. Because when we think about the conscience, we think about that as something that's inside of a person that speaks to a person silently and tells them when something that they're doing is wrong. And interestingly enough, as far as I'm concerned, the conscience only has the ability to say what's wrong. It doesn't tell you when something is right. It only says no. And in this case, this treaty is saying in surprisingly precise language that, you know, we don't know what the right thing to do is with nuclear technology, but using it for the purposes of weapons is a big no. And, you know, and that's not coming from, like, some surface level place. It's saying the conscience of the public. And the public is every person. You know, I'm I'm studying IT right now, and it's like in a public group, every user on the computer is in the public group. Every single one. You can't actually have a user that isn't in the public group. And so for every person, the idea of a nuclear weapon doesn't sit with them as a yes. Everybody inside feels, probably not. And, so I just want to stress that in a number of different ways, and hopefully one of them sticks.
Yeah, and I had you read that after our, your remarks about, the precedent and, the fact that international treaties make reference to other international treaties. And as you said, this is the Martens Clause, Martens being Fyodor Martens, who was the legal advisor for Tsar Nicholas II, who called the 1899 Hague Peace Conference, convened it. And this appears, I believe, the first time this appears in a treaty is in the 1907 Hague Convention on the Laws of War. So it has a pedigree, and I just want, that's why I had you read it, because it's yet another thing that you see. It's this, reference to this older principle, and that principle is put in there to sort of be, the catch-all. If we're not, capturing all of the atrocious things with our prohibitions, we're capturing anything that's abhorrent to the public conscience. So this notion of the public conscience also, very important later to Nuremberg, the whole idea of, shocking the conscience of mankind becomes a phrase that's used to describe the Holocaust. We might say now that not only is this abhorrent, it's shocking the conscience, the using nuclear weapons and, I think it's very disturbing that a country would agitate against this treaty. It's sort of shocking my conscience, actually. And I also wanted to add that, there's a voice in my head that tells me what to do. I don't know, maybe, Randy, you don't want to call that the conscience, but it's something, and I try to obey it as much as I can. Okay, so, Taylor, reaction to this? Sorry.
Yeah, I just wanted to refer back to Socrates,
Okay.
His daemon, he only says no, But,
yeah.
I mean, who knows whether that's a conscience or not. It's a long conversation.
Indeed. All right, yeah. Taylor?
Well, it's hard to follow Socrates, but I think that when it comes to understanding these basic principles of one's conscience and what's abhorrent to humanity, it kind of goes back to education, because I think, we were talking earlier in the show about the responsibility to understand, other people and to understand even oneself in terms of arguments. But I think there's also a responsibility to understand one's own consciousness and sort of connect to one's humanity. And that is, in a way, a sort of education to be able to think through and, listen, I guess, learn to listen to that little voice in your head telling you what's right and wrong and not listen to the more animalistic, parts of your brain that are power, food, greed, flashing lights on television. I think there is an education component to that. And with that, there's this international law, it seems very complex and everything, but I think Randy really got to the point of it being sort of, it's intuitive, no one wants nuclear war. I don't know, I think there is an education component to it, but it's not just external, it's also internal, because there is this internal logic to international law.
That's very, very Kantian of you to say such a thing, and that's not a bad thing. So learning to listen to the law, the inner law within, that's Immanuel Kant talked about, you don't need a lot of education to be to be moral. You just need to know how to listen and treat people with dignity. Nice point. And Michael.
Do you want me to comment on this, or do you want me to read my section of the
preamble? Whatever moves you at this point.
No, I think discussing Randy's sentence has been very profound. And it also reminded me of something that Beatrice Finn had talked about during the Al Jazeera discussion, that, you know, a lot of individuals hiccups when it comes to international laws, that there is no enforcement mechanism. But then she was like, wait, no, it goes beyond that. It's about changing the very dialogue and the thought process that we undergo when we think about something such as nuclear weapons. And by placing that value judgment of abhorrence to the principles of humanity and the dictates of public conscience, and that being within the treaty, is going to change the way individuals view this issue of nuclear weapons. And that is now going to be the discourse and dialogue through which further discussion on this issue functions through. And that's the 150 nations who have ratified this treaty are adhering themselves to. So I think that is a crucial and very important step in institutionalizing and enculturating these values into the world. And I think that's a very good step to have happen.
Yeah, and I just want to add to that as we have discussed, the treaty makes reference to the Habaksha, which are the victims of the atomic bombs, and their witness, their testimony, I think is so important to understanding why these weapons are abhorrent. So we can say it abstractly, but when you understand the details of what they saw, that's a sort of obligation, I think. And the treaty, as we've said, mentions them. And so that education absolutely involves listening to the only people who have suffered from the bomb. We have the Marshall Islands who testing as well, but the Habaksha, as we have said, their mission is peace, and they were very much involved in this treaty. So great. And actually, Michael, if you want to read your sentence, then we can close with a discussion of that.
Yeah, for sure. And it don't pertain to much of what we have discussed as well. So my section from the preamble says, quote, "Concerned by the slow pace of nuclear disarmament, the continued reliance on nuclear weapons and military and security concepts, doctrines, and policies, and the waste of economic and human resources on programs for the production, maintenance, and modernization of nuclear weapons." So lots to unpack, but I guess on sort of an immediate international law standards, that it sort of points to the Nuclear Nonproliferation Treaty, and that, you know, the end goal of that treaty was for nuclear disarmament. Even though there was no specified time frame, that was the end goal which nuclear nations were supposed to be working to, which has not happened. So there's where the slow pace comes in, and that's why this prohibition treaty is needed to truly, utterly, unilaterally state that this needs to happen. This denuclearization disarmament process needs to occur. And another really profound aspect of this, I think, which ties into the value judgment of abhorrent, is that word weight and the waste of human and economic resources. It's the waste of the human intellect and energy on the maintenance and creation of something so destructive, whereas in terms of nuclear weapons, I think nuclear power, that's a whole different realm, and the good that can come from that. But continuing to pour and use the human intellect on the maintenance and this modernization process that has been sort of beginning in the United States, beginning under the Obama administration and continue through the Trump administration, that to put that value judgment of weight, that this is not something we should be focusing our time, effort, and energy on, is also very important. And then that is also another framework through which these continued discussions will carry through. And I think that's also that's hugely important and just shows that there are other, there are way more important issues to be using this time, effort, and energy on instead of something so destructive, that we need to have positive construction happening for issues that will better and respect human dignity in the world.
Yeah. And I think also that when that this part of the preamble refers to the continued reliance on nuclear weapons in military and security concepts, doctrines, and policies. Also, we mentioned it last week, I just want to flag it again, this sort of dominant framework of deterrence, and that needs to be dismantled as well, that like our thinking about it has just not been effective. Cool. So we're about out of time, so what we'll do is just, you know, do a round robin again, and we'll start with Taylor, just final thoughts about the show, what we've said, other insights, et cetera.
So I think it all goes back, especially when it comes to any war, but in nuclear arms in particular, the point of them is to harm other people. And, you know, when we go back to the very first quote, the quote that Hope, that you brought up, this idea of self, of educating oneself and understanding international law as a necessity to fight tribalism and to, you know, understand one's own arguments and others' arguments is really important, because I think there's this demonization that occurs, and we so often focus on our own perspectives. And when I think going back to Michael's point about understanding our own rights, we have to look past sort of those animalistic tendencies and understand where our country and where we fit in the world. And there's just so much need for education and understanding in order to fight those impulses to destroy and destruct and, you know, use power. And that's ultimately what nuclear weapons are, is they're a source of power and security from a place of destruction. So.
Mm-hmm. All right, thanks. Michael?
Yeah, I would say that any individual who ends up coming across this podcast or is interested in this and many other aspects of the peace through law movement, nuclear disarmament, all of the above, that it's truly just continued education, continue internal work on the self, continuing to question where your beliefs and perceptions come from, continue to question which lens through which you are viewing an issue, then continue to look then inward to further that process of internal work to come to a state of dispelling your own ignorance for the sake of better understanding of the world around us. And truly that I was in those same shoes. The international realm can seem extremely complex and unnerving and way beyond any sort of average individual. But if you go through Randy's process of truly seeing it as just an interaction of individuals in these very human, intimate ways, that's what it boils down to. And it's been immensely helpful to me. And I've continued to learn much, both about myself and about this immense history and our current state in the world through that own process. So I would encourage anyone to just continue to do that for yourself, and you'll be better for it.
Mm-hmm. Cool. Randy?
Yeah, so the last point for me is that nuclear weapons, they're abhorrent because it's the supreme act of vanity of our species. It's this proclamation that we are the masters of nature. We understand everything to such a degree that we can manipulate things however we wish. and we can blow things up in the ocean, in the atmosphere, and there's no consequences because, well, we're just testing our toys and we don't care what happens. And it's that whole frame of mind that has to be destroyed. That whole sense of irresponsibility that I really think that the peace movement is working to dismantle all the way at the root, all the way at the bottom. I think that's the real battle there. Mm-hmm. And, you know, it doesn't take very long to understand that that's the right side of the fence to be on, because, like, when we're testing a nuclear torpedo, and then we know that there are side effects that emerge in the life forms around nuclear explosions, and we know that we have to eat the fish in the ocean, we quickly find out that the bomb is hurting ourselves. It doesn't take that many levels to get back to the fact that we're just cutting the branch that we're sitting on. You know, we're sawing our own seed off. And we need to be more responsible with the power that we have as a species. And our job is not dominion, it's stewardship. Mm-hmm. And so the quicker we get into the, you know, into that place, the better. And as far as I understand it, the peace through arbitration movement is a compelling force making the structures upon which we can get to that place as a collective a little bit faster.
All right. Well, on that note, we will just conclude this show. You have been listening to Virtues of Peace. We have been talking about both Elihu Root's 1907 article, The Need of Popular Understanding of International Law, and then a little bit more on the treaty on the prohibition on nuclear weapons. As we've said, you know, we really encourage you. You can see, like, we've only been talking about the preamble. And the preamble, as we've said, relates to many other pieces of this framework that goes back to the 19th century, quite frankly. The Martens Clause is proof positive of that. But the UN Charter, the Non-Proliferation Treaty, the Comprehensive Test Ban Treaty, international humanitarian law, and international human rights law. All of these things are part of this framework that I think Randy is talking about, to sort of move from dominance to stewardship. It's beautifully put. So we will be back next week, not talking about nuclear weapons, but something else equally important. And so I'll say goodbye, and until next week, you've been listening to Virtues of Peace. Bye-bye.